Thank you. Yeah, so I've tried to review the properties and especially to make comparison between jets in these three different classes of sources. So I'll briefly go through the evidence we have for jets, which is very good for AGNs, especially because we have images, and it's kind of less direct for gamma ray bursts, as we will see. Yet we still have we are still pretty convinced that we have jets there. And the main part of this talk, I guess, will be trying to understand what are the similarities and the difference between these three kinds of jets, and whether there are simple scalings between jet properties and black hole mass or magnetic fields or other quantities related more to the physical mechanism that may produce the jets. I will, since my main area of research is gamma ray bursts, then I will investigate a bit in more detail something about gamma ray burst jets, and of course I will finish with a summary and discussion. So what's the evidence for AGN jets? Well, this is a pretty good evidence. Jets in all wavelengths, and this is AM87 from radio to optical to X-rays. Not for all AGNs we have such pretty pictures, but still we have convincing evidence of jets, also in blazar-like jets, jets that point towards us so we can see the whole structure. But we have superluminal motions, which, as Martin Rees taught us in the 60s, are a great evidence for jets pointing towards us, and jets that expand at relativistic speed. Analogous situation is for galactic jets coming from microquasars. Here is a radio image of a clear double-sided jet, and we also have from radio observations superluminal motions, and so again relativistic jets. What about gamma ray bursts? Gamma ray bursts are sources as small in physical size probably as galactic microquasars, but they are at cosmological distance, so it's pretty hard both to get this kind of evidence, or even worse, for this kind of evidence. So we have to rely on some indirect evidence that comes from considerations on relativistic kinematics. So what we think we have is a jet, which is quite a wide jet. The geometrical beaming of the plasma is wider than the relativistic beaming of photons. So what happens is that if we are looking, for example, along a line of sight at the center of this jet, we cannot see radiation from the edges because the radiation is beamed away from us. And so we have that the jet produces radiation in a certain beam that is coincident with the geometric beam of the jet, and we have a certain light curve. Now, what I'm talking about is not the gamma ray burst prompt emission, but it's the afterglow emission. That's the phase when the jet is interacting with the external medium that slows down the jet. And so as time goes on, the jet expands, and it slows down because it is loaded by mass from the interstellar medium, and the relativistic beaming of photons widens. It's still at this stage narrower than the geometric beaming of the plasma, and so our light curve just goes on as if nothing happened. At some point, as the jet propagates out, it becomes so slow that the relativistic beaming of radiation is wider than the geometric beaming of the plasma. And at this stage, the radiation is beamed in a wider cone. But since our telescope is sensitive to the radiation per unit solid angle, if we increase the solid angle, we decrease the radiation per unit solid angle. And what we see is a break in the light curve. And this can be either such a simple picture as this one, in which only the photons are beamed in a wider cone. It may also be that the whole expands because it's hot in its own rest frame, so if it can, it would spread sideways. And this doesn't change the picture more than qualitatively. The effect is that the break that we see here should be sharper. An important feature of this break is that is entirely due to a geometrical effect. So it has nothing to do with at which frequency we are observing. So this feature in the light curve should be achromatic. And indeed, this is the best evidence of jets we have in gamma ray burst. What you see here is the afterglow light curve of one burst of a couple of years ago. And you see in red R-band imaging in the optical. And in black, you see X-rays from XDE and XMM down here. And you see that if I fit both the optical, at least the early optical, then it gets complicated by supernova components and other stuff. But if I fit the early optical light curve with a broken power law and the X-ray light curve with a broken power law, I end up with two power laws that have break at comparable times. So over three orders of magnitude in frequency, we do have a simultaneous break. And this can be very well explained by a jet break. So after I convinced you we have jets in all these three classes of sources, let's go and see what are the properties of these jets. And let's start, for example, from the duration that we think these jets have. In AGNs, in active galactic nuclei, we know that the jets last for a long time because we see radial lobes onto which energy has been damped for a long time. And what happens is that the jet has time not only lasts for a long time on the timescale of the engine, of the black hole that generates it, but it lasts for a long time also for timescale of its surroundings. So what we see is these very narrowly collimated jets, which are probably collimated also by the interaction with a high-pressure cocoon that surrounds them. So they sort of reach a sort of way of living together with their environment. And the same seems to be true for microquasars, even though in some cases it seems that in microquasars the jet is not such a continuous feature, but it has a more bursting activity, which may be either bursting in the real jet emission, or it may be that the jet is actually continuous, but it's a radiative phase that it bursts at some point. I would say that there is good evidence that it's actually the jet itself that forms and disappears, but it may still be that it's only what we see that disappear. It's quite interesting, I think, that in gamma ray burst, the situation is different. The jet in gamma ray burst lasts for about 100 seconds, and this is a huge amount of time in terms of the timescale of the black hole. So it's actually improper to call gamma ray burst explosions from this point of view, because the jet lasts for 10,000 dynamical timescale of the inner engine. However, if we consider the interaction of the jet with the surroundings, the jet is pretty fast. There's no time for the jet and the environment to reach an equilibrium state. And this, I will come back to this at the end, may be quite interesting, because we may be able to see the jet properties as they are given to him by the inner engine. There is no nurturing of the jet by interaction with other stuff. It's just that what you see is what you get from the inner engine, with some, as I will show in the end, with some caution. Okay, I guess I already said this thing, the duration in terms of the engine timescale. What about Lorentz factor? So we can measure quite accurately Lorentz factor, or at least lower limits Lorentz factors in any superluminal source. And for AGN jets, we get usually Lorentz factor in the range 10 to 30. Some 30 is a kind of an extreme case. And this is especially easy to do for blazars, for jets that point towards us. For these jets that go sideways, is not so easy to infer a Lorentz factor. But we know that AGN jets can reach this kind of 10-ish Lorentz factor. In microquasars, it seems that the Lorentz factor is quite smaller, of the order of 2.5 to 10, and it's gained mainly measured through reconstructing the geometry in superluminal sources. And in gamma ray bursts, again, the evidence for relativistic expansion is less direct. And there is this quite robust limit of Lorentz factor larger than 100, which comes from the fact that we do see non-thermal spectra of gamma ray bursts extending well beyond the pair production threshold. And coupling this with variability information, in order to get a source that is optically thin to photon-photon interaction to product pairs, you need this kind of Lorentz factors. And one immediately sees here that there is no sort of immediate scaling of the Lorentz factor with other properties of the sources. The luminosity of these jets, and by luminosity I mean not the luminosity of the radiation we see, but the amount of energy that comes out of the inner engine. And this is not an extremely easy quantity to measure, because the beaming correction is not, you can estimate beamings, but sometimes not with a huge precision. There's very little known about the radiative efficiency, so mainly we measure photons from these sources, but that we don't know how much energy we need to have this amount of photons radiated. And also, by measuring photons, it's the luminosity in photons is a good proxy for the energy in leptons, in either electron or positron. And it's not easy to know how much these jets are dominated by leptons and whether there's a sizable baryon component in protons. And of course, in terms of kinetic energy, protons can carry quite a huge amount of energy. So there is this difficulty that it's inherent in any estimate of the luminosity. Anyway, for AGNs, this turns out to be of the order of 10 to the 43, 48 Hz per second. It's smaller in microquasars and is big in gamma ray bursts, as we know, the most luminous sources in the universe after the Big Bang. That's a poster. Now, why I'm going through these numbers? Well, the second quantity I want to discuss is, of course, basically how much energy we have available. And as has been already discussed in this meeting, the best source for jets is a rotating black hole. And so we have measure of the black hole mass for AGNs of the order of a billion or 100 million, 100 million solar masses. It's of the order of 10 solar masses for microquasars, and it's supposed to be between 1 and few solar masses for gamma ray bursts. And this means that these sources have this available rotational energy for a maximally rotating black hole. and I go back to this luminosity later. And we can now plug in a mechanism for energy extraction from the black hole. And if we assume Blanford-Znaek, and we know the mass, we assume that the black hole is maximally spinning, and we assume that we can measure the jet luminosity accurately enough, it turns out that we need magnetic fields of the order of 10 to the 4 in AGNs, 5 times 10 to the 8 in microquasars, and a sort of magnetar scale magnetic field for black holes in order to extract such a huge luminosity. Now, it's interesting to compare this energy that we, this magnetic field that we require, with the amount of material that we have surrounding the black hole. And this can be estimated at least in AGNs and in microquasars through the disk luminosity. This disk luminosity allows us to infer the density of material in the disk. Oh, that's Gauss. Sorry. That's all CGS units. so we see in some AGNs, we can measure the disk luminosity directly from the UV bump in their spectra. In some other cases, we don't have such a direct luminosity measurement, but we can, by observing the luminosity of the broad absorption lines and assuming some efficiency in the scattering of the disk radiation from the broad absorption lines, we can infer disk luminosities of the order of 10 to the 42, 10 to the 47. And in microquasars, we do observe the disk, and we have this kind of luminosity, 10 to the 38, 10 to the 39 arcs per second. In gamma ray burst, we do not see the disk. What I will be doing now is compute, tell you what's the result. If I compute the energy density in the surrounding of the black hole, I assume that the magnetic field is in equipartition with the matter here. And I will compare the magnetic fields I get with the magnetic fields that I require for Bland-Fresnayek to give me such a power in the jets. And it turns out that under this assumption, the numbers, I didn't write them again because are exactly of the same order of magnitude. I end up with having in equipartition magnetic fields of the order of 10 to the 4 Gauss in AGNs, 5, 10 to the 8 in microquasars. And in gamma reverse, if I assume that there's the outflow is powered by a solar mass accretion disk that is completely damped into the black hole on a timescale of the burst duration, and that the efficiency in terms of m dot into the black hole versus e dot into the jet is the same as in these sources here, I end up with a magnetic field that is the order of 10 to the 15 Gauss. So this is sort of the most direct scaling you can find in these sources. So there is no scaling with black hole mass. Luminosity doesn't scale with black hole mass, doesn't scale directly with magnetic fields, but it scales. I mean, this parameter, if you want, how much magnetic field I need to power the jet over how much magnetic field I can support in the disk, is roughly unity and constant in all these sources. Okay. Then I would like to talk a little bit about something I already discussed before. So we are able to power these jets, but usually we produce an outflow of plasma or of Poynting flux. How do we produce photons? How do we dissipate this relativistic outflow to produce radiation that we see? And of course, it's very easy if you just have a lot of interstellar material and you take outflowing jet, and you just crash onto the interstellar material. This produces a lot of heat. But what we see is that the jets are bright when they are still jets. So we must find a way to have some dissipation while the jet is still relativistically outflowing. And for hydrodynamic jet, if the magnetic field is not dominant on the jet length scales, all the mechanisms that are proposed involve shocks in some fashion. One idea is that you just have a continuous jet and shocks going through the jet. Another idea that is that what are called the internal shocks, in which the jet is not a continuous, at least in terms of all its properties, but it has, for example, higher density and lower density sections, or higher Lorentz factor and lower Lorentz factor sections, and these sort of dishomogeneities at some point will reach a critical phase in which they relax by collision to each other onto each other and generating shocks and dissipating. A sort of generic feature of this kind of models is a somewhat low efficiency. Basically, this it's It's kind of like having a car accident. If you go on a freeway and you collapse into the car ahead of you, it's much better than making a head-on collision on a two-direction road. So there's sort of a, unless the velocity spread is huge, you cannot usually extract a huge amount of energy by this mechanism. And this is sort of good for AGN jets and microquasars, where the radiation efficiency is usually inferred to be in the 10% even less range. And this is because we see, for example, radio lobes, and we can compute how much energy is in the radio lobe compared to how much energy the jet is radiating in the jet phase. And we see that the jet is not such a good radiator. It only dissipates order of 10%. In gamma ray burst, the situation is quite different. It seems that gamma ray bursts need to be much more efficient in radiating their power while still in the jet phase. And this may be related to the way gamma ray burst jets are created, as I will show you in the next slide. And I should mention there are models in which the jet is dominated by magnetic field. And in this case, of course, the physics is completely different. You don't have shocks, but you may have reconnection and produce radiation by this dissipation mechanism. Now, I want to show in the last 10 minutes or so I have some of the work we are doing in Colorado about, and this is especially for gamma ray burst jets. But it has, of course, relevance to several questions for jets in general. And especially what I want to discuss here is the question I was asking myself before, whether gamma ray burst jets are really a good family of jets for observing the jet as it is produced by the inner engine or not. Because in principle, they may be, because the jet lasts for such a short time scale that it doesn't have that much time to interact with its surrounding and be recollimated or so on. But it may also be that the interaction with the star, that it's here, creates actually a lot of feedback with the jet that destroys, in partly or completely, what the engine is producing, or at least reshuffles completely information. And the other question is whether there is any reason why gamma ray burst jets should be should have a higher radiative efficiency. Okay, so what you see here is a star, a compact star of radius of kind of 10 to the 11 centimeters. It has lost all the hydrogen and helium envelopes, so it's gone through a Wolf-Rayet wind phase or through a binary interaction phase. So what we are assuming is that, and the reason why I'm taking this class of stars is because all the supernova explosions that we see associated with gamma ray bursts are for stars, for progenitors of stars of this kind, without any hydrogen or helium. So I'm taking a 15 solar massive star with a power law decreasing density, which is, of course, not a physical model, but it's kind of good for an evolved star of this kind. And I'm basically postulating as a boundary condition in the core an outflow with 10 to the 50 Earth per second luminosity, and starting off with a Lorentz factor of 10 and enough entropy so that if all the internal energy should be converted into bulk outflow, this would go up to a Lorentz factor of about 300 or so. And the jet is postulated with an opening angle of 5 degrees. So it's basically a radial outflow with an opening angle of 5 degrees and this kind of luminosity. And this movie, you have already seen several times while I was speaking, is a color-coded movie of the density, in which you see the jet going through the star. And the main thing we see is that there is one information that is lost almost immediately, and this is the opening angle of the jet. The jet is immediately recollimated by the interaction with the star. You see, it looks like more like a cylindrical jet than a conical outflow. So there is indeed a lot of nurturing of the jet by the interaction with the star. And then you see the jet breaking out. And you may ask, is this jet relativistic at all? And yeah, luckily, this is relativistic. So it's consistent with being a gamma ray burst jet. This is a movie, again, of the Lorentz factor in this case. And you see that the jet goes through the star and it can reach a Lorentz factor as high as at least 40 in this case. But there is a lot of interaction with the star. So about the two questions, whether I can use these kind of jets to say what the inner engine or the black hole, if we want to call it a black hole, is doing, and whether gamma ray bursts can be more efficient in dissipation. And I will go to a less fancy representation of this, but possibly more physically inciting. So what you see here is the same simulation, three panels. One is density, one is pressure, and one is Lorentz factor. And the Lorentz factor is rescaled in this direction by a factor of 4. So that's why you see the whole curvature, and here you see this thing that goes out. Basically, this point here corresponds to roughly this place here in the other two plots. And there are two features. The first one is that it's true that the jet, I mean, this jet has constant luminosity at the base. But while it's still inside the star, while the head of the jet is still inside the star, and this the upper square panels are basically just before the jet breaks through the stellar surface, there's a lot of structure that is produced by recollimation through tangential shocks, through oblique shocks. And especially in the Lorentz factor, there's a lot of structure. And this is quite interesting, because if we want to think in terms of an internal shock scenario, then this is quite good for increasing our dissipation. So is it possible that gamma ray bursts dissipate more because of the interaction with the star? It seemed to be yes. And the other question seems to be no. There's nothing here that has to do with what the inner engine is doing. Now, the important thing also to consider is that in gamma ray burst jet, don't die at the moment they break out on the star. Gamma ray bursts last for 100 to almost 1,000 seconds, and this moment here is 9 seconds after the burst explosion, the sort of beginning of the outflow. And what you see in this panel here, that is the longest time we've been able to run our simulation, is that if we concentrate inside the star, which is basically the 100 here is the radius of the star, this is in unit of 10 to the 9 centimeters, lots of this structure seems to be lost. Basically, what happens is that the propagation of the jet through the star is releasing an amount of order 10 to the 50, 10 to the 51 ergs in the star. And this is enough to explode the star. So the star, on a time scale of tens of seconds, is starting to blow away. So if it's true that the jet is nurtured a lot in the beginning, it's true as well that at some point, what we get, what we see, is what we get from the inner engine. Now, of course, I would really like to show you what happens if I run this simulation for 20 or 30 seconds more, and maybe next conference I will be able to do it. But it's clear that there's a lot less shocks and things going on here. So it may turn out that that indeed I should turn around the questions, and the question is whether gamma ray bursts can be very efficient because of these things is no, because only the first 5 seconds of the flow should be very efficient for the interaction of the star. And whether I should take what I get in gamma ray burst jet as what is being produced by the inner engine is yes, because I only have to cut out the first 5 or 10 seconds, and then if I go there, I will have sort of a clear look of the inner engine. Whether I'm convinced more of the first of the first or the second version of these two answers, it's kind of hard to say, because if we look at gamma ray burst light curve, there doesn't seem to be any big transition after a few seconds. They seem to have this kind of the same properties all over the emission. And so what's going on? It may be that this part is actually not enough accelerated, and so it doesn't produce the gamma rays we want to see, and this may produce either precursor or something at lower energies, and so we really only need to look at this smooth jet. And in that case, it would be a mystery why the radiative efficiency is so large. It may be instead that the jet is all nurtured by the star, and by some feedback mechanism is shut off. It just the engine shuts down when the jet reaches the surface of the star, maybe because of the stellar explosion itself. And I will just go to my discussion. It's basically a summary of what I've said. So we see relativistic jets in a wide class of sources. We go from supermassive black holes of millions of solar masses to sources with kind of one solar mass. And it's kind of interesting that even though we do not see any easy scaling, for example, for Lorentz factor or for the luminosity of the jet, we do see that it seems that the jet power is as powerful as it can be given the properties of the accretion disk. So this may be plugged in the discussion before about what's the role of having material around the black hole for the Blanchflor-Znaek extraction, and the answer is it seems it is important at least in providing the magnetic field. Thanks.
Okay, Daniel. The simulation you showed were basically a relativistic hydro, right?
Yeah.
And is Flash a relativistic code now?
Yeah, it's been released a new version a couple of months ago with a special relativistic module.
So I'm a little bit confused about the role of magnetic fields of Branford and Znaek effect in producing the jet. And then in what you said later, in relation to the hydrodynamical propagation of the jet. If the jet is produced by magnetic effects, I think propagation process is related with the jet, as it makes its way through the star would be also important. So that I found a little bit unclear.
I agree with you. I would love to have in hand an adaptive mesh, relativistic MHD code.
No, but not about simulations, but in terms of physics.
In terms of physics, it may be, I think, that what happens is that the sigma, the ratio of magnetic energy to normal baryon energy is one or more at the moment the jet is launched. But it's not clear to me or evidence that it should stay magnetically dominated. It may pick up some material from the star and becomes an hydrodynamic jet with a contribution of magnetic field which is not dominant for the dynamics, so with sigma of 1/10 or so. All the models for gamma ray bursts are based on basically jets that are matter dominated. Which may be wrong, but that's what people have been doing so far. And since the jet has to go through this very dense star, it may pick up enough baryons to undergo a transition from a launching part of the jet, when the magnetic fields have a dominant role, to a propagation and then a radiative phase in which you have a particle-dominated flow. And in one case, we do see what we think is a shock going back into the jet. And this, since you have a shock and you can model the properties of the emission from this shock with a non-dominant magnetic field, this seems to be, at least in this case, a proof that this transition took place.
I have just one quick technical question for the simulation that you showed. Where did you launch the jet from? What radius?
It's 10^9.
Okay. And the second thing is more of a comment. I just wanted to bring this up. In many of the simulations we've seen of black hole accretion, which I think we'll see more of, there's a lot of outside of the jet. There is there's some sort of wind, like a mass-loaded wind. You emphasize the importance of the jet in affecting the structure of the star and perhaps decreasing the amount of collimation that you might get on late times. But if Stan Woosley or Andrew McFadyen were here, they would say that in order to create the supernovae that attended the gamma ray burst associated with 1998 BW and 2003 DH, there had to be a mass-loaded, nickel-rich wind. And so it's also that wind which carries perhaps even more energy that might also dissemble the star and might also affect the collimation on those scales of 10^9, 10^10 centimeters. So it's not just the destruction of the envelope by the jet itself, but also this wind which isn't present in your calculations. I was wondering if you could just comment on that a little bit, or if that's worth thinking about.
So you're right, this wind is not in the simulation. So this wind was studied by McFadyen and Woosley, because otherwise you wouldn't have a supernova at all in these explosions. On the other hand, if you speak with the supernova side of the hypernova business, what they do assume is that there is a supernova associated, maybe because you don't form a black hole straight away, you form a neutron star and then you accrete and it goes into a black hole. So you may there are many fashions in which this model can come. It may be a spherical explosion with a jet, it may be a jet and the wind, and in this case I agree with you that the cocoon collimation that we have here may not be the whole game, even though these cocoon are quite high pressure, so I think they would be able also to deflect the wind, but it would change dynamics. And you may also have that in some, especially in X-ray flash, in some cases we do not see the supernova, and it may be because you don't have neither the wind, neither the spherical explosion, and you just have a jet.
How good is the observational evidence that there is a change in Lorentz factor between the microquasars and the quasar jets?
Uh-huh.
Because it was only a factor of 2 or 3 that you were talking about there, and over a 10^8 change in mass, and that seemed so close as to be close.
As far as I know, these numbers come from superluminal motions, and the apparent beta we see in AGNs are larger than what we see in microquasars.
But there are no microquasars that are tipped very close to our line of sight, so.
Yeah, it may be a statistics, because we have more superluminal AGNs, and so we have kind of all the orientations, and that's not true for the microquasars.
So I have a general question from a non-GRB specialist. A few years ago, everyone was hung up on the baryon loading problem, and that you couldn't accelerate these very high Lorentz factor jets unless they were very clean, you know, very, very few baryons. So my basic question is, what happened to the baryon loading problem? We're trying to push this jet through 15 solar masses of baryons now. You know, surely it's going to pick up some fraction of those.
Okay, so the first part of the question is that we inject as a boundary condition a jet which is very clean. Then there's the problem, how come this jet doesn't pick up a huge amount of matter into the star? And the reason is that the jet drives this bow shock into the star, and the head of this bow shock is propagating subrelativistically. So the material it had is high pressure and has all the time to move to the sides and don't pollute the jet. The other issue is whether the contact discontinuity between the jet and the star does allow some turbulent mixing or something like that. And the smallest mixing scales are still not resolved in this kind of simulations. It doesn't seem to be, there may be some effect on the boundaries of the jet, it doesn't seem this on the sides, it doesn't seem it will reach the spine of the jet. but we still have to have higher resolution simulations to address this. We do see jets from stars, so we are sort of kind of optimistic that the results will be possible.
David, first a comment. When you put the Blanford Znaek for the estimates of the field, I guess it was generic, that it doesn't have, it can come from the disk, doesn't necessarily have to come from the hole. Your estimates would still be similar. On the issue of the efficiency, I think it's very difficult to, and people who looked into it, it's very difficult to account for the very high efficiency that you really need, which are tens of percent under whatever circumstances you do, even if you go to very extreme non-uniform distributions of the Lorentz factors. So tweaking with it, I don't think would really help in that respect. And one way out of it could be that the problem isn't really there, that we are overestimating the gamma ray luminosity because we are using the angle that comes from the jet break. I don't want to get too into it, from the jet break of a wide component whereas there's actually a narrow component where the gamma ray burst comes from. And so we're overestimating the up to an order of magnitude.
I know what you're talking about, and I hope I can answer you and that everybody will be able to understand without spending 50 minutes. So he's basically saying that maybe we are estimating the total kinetic energy of the outflow that includes a relativistic part and a non-relativistic part and the gamma ray energy from a different output. My question to that is that I think to make it work, you have to fine-tune the numbers a little bit to get efficiencies as high as 50%. Because if the wide component is too wide, then it has too much energy, and you would actually infer a wrong efficiency, but a smaller one than the real one.
So, do you have an idea how much energy goes into turbulent motion in the star? And if you take a cold jet, for example, with those pressures much smaller than the rest mass energy density, do you get a different result?
Okay, so for turbulence, with the length scales that we are able to resolve now, we don't see much turbulence. As far as starting with a cold jet, I could answer what happens if you start with a very hot jet. With a cold jet, my intuition would say the thing wouldn't change too much, because this jet is already quite cold. We tried simulations with jets that have almost all the energy into thermal energy at the beginning, and moving from those jets to this Lorentz factor of 10. Well, the Lorentz factor, the final Lorentz factor, is the product of the two energies. So it's 10 times 10. It's 10 times 30. Yeah. So it's order of magnitude similar. I mean, it's not 10 and 10,000. But the short answer is we haven't done the simulation, so I don't know what happens. But
yeah, I would like you to say something more about those three types of systems you were talking about. AGN, we know about them, that they are luminous. We see radiation, and we think it's accretion-driven. We see also the directly jets. Microquasars, the same story. We in gamma ray bursts, we don't see directly jets. We only infer their existence. Plus, we don't see, as you said, radiation output from accretion, which is most likely occurring there. So my question is it obvious why we don't see any emission related to the accretion processes?
In gamma ray bursts?
Yeah, in gamma ray bursts.
It's because
at any time?
You have an optical depth of, well, there's two reasons. One is that in the initial phase when the disk is massive, you have the whole star surrounding it, and its optical depth is the jet itself is optically thick, and if the idea is that the jet dies because the disk disappears, the jet itself is an optical Oh, short gamma burst is a completely different business.
Final question, Elliot.
I just want a short comment and a question. Comment that maybe we have direct proof that gamma bursts are relativistic by proper measuring the proper motion in two cases, right, of the afterglow.
Yeah. Well, we measure through interstellar scintillation that the source undergoes a transition from unresolved to resolved, and this implies Lorentz factor of 4 at least, and this is in the afterglow phase. So we have some evidence of.
And then there, I know that you were discussing the standard model for gamma ray burst, but do we really have evidence for jets in gamma ray burst? Because, and which is in your opinion the best evidence we have? Because you are a co-author of a paper in which the break in the jet has been explained with other model than the jet being there, and in this paper also you cured the energy crisis and so on. So we do really have the evidence for collimated jets in gamma ray burst?
You mean for we may either have jets like the ones that we see in AGNs, where we have a jet with nothing outside, or it may be a sort of more of a structural outflow that may also you may basically have a very luminous spine with also outflows on the sides with less energy than that, and this is a possibility. And actually, these models here do predict some structure in the jet that may actually produce eventually a sort of structure jet with a fast, very relativistic spine and some less energetic and maybe slower wings that would produce the same phenomenology in the afterglow. I would call them jets anyway.
Okay, thank you. Let's thank Davide again.